When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of I Know That Face, the podcast which honours the often underappreciated by the masses work of character actors. I'm Stephen Portia.
My name's Andrew Carroll.
And we are back talking about character actors with an episode all about the seemingly shape-shifting Andrea Riseborough.
Yeah, the chameleon herself.
Exactly. Andrew, run down her history.
Andrea Riseborough was born in Newcastle in 1981. She was involved in theatre from a young age and attended RADA, or the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and graduated from there in 2005. Her earliest roles include the Peter O'Toole film Venus and an episode of the mam-friendly TV show Doc Martin. Her rise began when she was nominated for a BAFTA for playing Margaret Thatcher in the TV movie The Long Walk to Finchley. In 2010, she appeared in the comedy Maid in Dagenham, the tragedy Never Let Me Go, and the thriller Brighton Rock. In 2013, Hollywood came calling and Riseborough played Victoria in the Tom Cruise sci-fi film Oblivion. 2013 also saw her star in the proper British thriller Welcome to the Punch. I have the tea taken out, so I know to say, British.
Great. It's British heat,
isn't it? And not very good either. Riseborough has worked solidly since then, appearing in at least two films every year, including Birdman, Nocturnal Animals, Battle of the Sexes, The Death of Stalin, and Mandy. 2020 saw her star in two horror films. Those were Nicholas Pesci's The Grudge and Brandon Cronenberg's Possessor, which we've covered in our Jennifer Jason Leigh episode.
Sure.
You could consider this a spiritual sequel to that.
I suppose so. Yeah.
In a surprise nod in 2022, Andrea Riseborough was nominated for the Oscar for Best Actress for her role in Two Leslie. Riseborough has also maintained a successful and selective TV career, appearing in miniseries such as The Devil's Whore, National Treasure, Waco, 000, and the episode Crocodile from season 4 of Black Mirror. Her most recent work includes the war film Lee, starring Kate Winslet, and the miniseries Alice and Jack, opposite her longtime friend Donald Gleeson, and the Kate Winslet starring miniseries The Regime.
She's in a lot of stuff, and I don't think you even mentioned
with Kate Winslet.
Bloodline season 2. Which
I didn't mention Bloodline
role.
Season 2 because I haven't seen it. She is set to star in the supernatural thriller Geechee, which will be produced by Jamie Foxx.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Did I flub everything else? And yet it just shows that I don't read my own intros because I have Jamis Foxx written here.
Yeah. I've been a huge fan of Riseborough ever since seeing her in Shadow Dancer in cinemas in 2012, which is a really good movie about a woman in the IRA who's arrested and forced to become an MI5 informant. If you haven't seen it, check it out. But as I mentioned in my intro, throughout her career, I'm just constantly amazed by her ability to transform herself radically for different parts in a career full of very diverse work, I think. Like, she's a bit like I Know That Face all-star Tilda Swinton in that respect. Mm. And she's 20 years younger than Tilda Swinton, but I can see Riseborough in the future maybe attaining a similar level of fame to her.
Cutting her hair similarly.
Maybe. Yeah, I think I've seen her in interviews rocking short hair.
Yeah, yeah.
Two other things about her that I'm always huge impressed by. She's not very precious about her image in that, like, she will routinely play characters that can be quite unsympathetic, whether it be in movies like Two Leslie or Possessor, or even her, like, supporting role in Amsterdam, or in TV, like that Black Mirror episode you mentioned, or 000, where she's like Al Pacino as Michael Corleone level, like, powerhouse.
Just business.
I think is she American or not? I can't remember. Yeah. She plays Gabriel Byrne's daughter in it. Even her new show, Alice and Jack, which I'll admit I've only seen snippets of, like, the people I know who have watched it have told me, like, she's a prickly character in the show.
Yeah.
But I think generally when she plays characters like that, she makes them very compelling and interesting. And I also love that she's just down to star in some gnarly movies like Mandy or Possessor or The Grudge. Like, that's a great little trilogy of messed up horror thrillers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Will we kick off with the aforementioned Welcome to the Punch?
Let's go.
I have the plot here.
Yeah.
I actually like this movie. I'll say I have a soft spot for it.
No, it's got something. I'm not like a total hater.
Yeah,
I have a nice memory of it because it was like one of the films me and my uncle watched over it. Shout out to you, Brendan. who I think is one of my own, the only family members I have that actually listens to this podcast on a consistent basis. So thanks for that, Brendan. And the rest of you, get in gear. And we like rented it from Extravision back in 2013 and watched it together when I was staying with him down in Athlone. So that's a nice memory I have.
That's so funny you said that, because I had prepared notes about how I went to see this movie with my dad in the cinema, and it was like during a period where I was starting to get more into like cinema going as like a thing to do every week and like checking out like adult non-blockbustery stuff. So I think of like Welcome to the Punch, another James McAvoy movie, Trance, Side Effects, Stoker were all movies that came around the same period. And they were kind of in my head because they've all just recently had 10-year anniversaries. They're all really good. But so this is a London-set crime thriller that begins with D.I. Max Lewinsky, played by James McAvoy, in hot pursuit of a gang of professional thieves led by notorious criminal Jacob Sternwood, played by Mark Strong. And they've just pulled off a job. Eventually, Lewinsky and Sternwood face off against each other, with the thief shooting the cop in the leg and escaping. 3 years later, a young man is found suffering from a serious gunshot wound at an airport after trying to flee the country. Turns out, it's Jacob Sternwood's son, Ruin. This leads to the notorious criminal returning to the UK to find out what happened to his kid. All the while, Lewinsky, who's been left permanently damaged from the shooting 3 years ago, he has to inject pus out of his knee every morning. He sees this turn of events as the perfect opportunity to catch the thief that once eluded him. However, as Lewinsky and his new partner, D.S. Sarah Hawkes, played by Andrew Riseborough, and also Sternwood, conduct separate investigations into Ruin's recent shooting, they stumble into a conspiracy with far-reaching implications.
Take it we're not staying here.
You are.
I'm going to go track down this security guard, see if he's been squared off by Sternwood.
What, you think he shot his own son?
No, I think he's been planning something. It fucked up and now he's covering his tracks.
Can you just take a step back for a minute?
What the fuck's that supposed to mean?
Meaning maybe it's not all about Jacob Sternwood.
What else is it about?
Dean Warnes, for a start, and a dead 22-year-old.
Yeah, which all lead back to Jacob Sternwood. I've just got to figure out how.
You, right.
Not me.
Right, you know what? Catching Sternwood is not going to change the past.
It has to. Well, I'm always going to be that nobody that got shot in a tunnel and let him get away with it.
Listen.
Don't.
Please.
Sarah.
Listen to me. What went down in that tunnel does not make you a nobody. Hey, trust me. Concentrate on now. Because you're too good at your job to waste it.
I wouldn't say Welcome to the Punch is heat in London. Like, I think it's less ambitious.
It's pretty close, though.
It's only like 99 minutes with credits or whatever. But like, it does have a little bit of its juice in that like, it's two tough brooding protagonists, each on opposite side of the law, seemingly destined to collide. And I also think Aaron Creevy, who directed this and who I thought would go on to have a bigger career based on this and his debut movie Shifty, which is really good. But he just did work on the Netflix show The Gentleman with Guy Ritchie. But I think he captures a bit of that Michael Mann magic here in making the film feel as sleek and stylish as possible while also feeling rooted in a real world place. And I just think the color grading in Welcome to Punch is really nice, like that kind of blue-green palette combined with those big buildings and reflective surfaces of modern London city. Just looks very visually pleasing. It's probably the best London, I think, has looked in a movie since Basic Instinct 2, which this shares a cast member in David Morrissey.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, what do you think of it?
I think this feels like an adaptation of the second book in a trilogy, or like the sixth entry of one of those endless series of cop novels. Like, it feels like, I know this movie,
I love those.
Yeah, I like them too. Yeah. But I would like to see what happened before, you know?
Or after,
yeah.
It ends kind of abruptly.
It does, yeah. It feels like there's more story to tell. It feels like if maybe he'd had the budget, he was going to try and make London set heat between these two people and just didn't have the time or the money. And like I said, that's not necessarily a bad thing that it feels like this. It's clear these characters have history with each other, whether we see it or not, and a game cast usually fills in the blanks where the script or the audience can't. It's full of great English character actors like Peter Mullan. He's
so
Scottish.
I should say
Peter Mullan is Scottish.
So with the Tom Sizemore to Mark Strong's Robert De Niro in this?
I guess so. Yeah. A bit more of a sort of jokey personality than Tom Sizemore.
Sure.
Yeah.
The bit where he gets shot and he's like, I can't feel my legs. And he's like, really? He's like, no.
Yeah, he's so only been funny. Shot in the shoulder. Yeah. Or he's fixing the vending machine, but he's actually like putting an Uzi under it.
Yeah, that
And
you're
like, you can't be here. He's like, and he pretends to be on the phone. It's like, that fucker's a fucking moron.
Sending me to the wrong place.
Yeah,
that's great.
David Morrissey, as you said, Johnny Harris and Jason Fleming.
There's an Oscar winner in this cast.
Yeah.
Danny Kaluuya.
That's true. There is, yeah. Forgot about Danny Kaluuya. Yeah, actually, he's mentioned in my last note. But anyway, and Jason Fleming shows up for a little bit.
Daniel Mays, who's the guy whose whole thing is, I have glasses.
Yeah, that's true. He really treats them like a prop.
I know.
And they're not good enough looking to be a prop.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
They make him look really nerdy. Like he shouldn't be using like an assault rifle in a nightclub.
Yeah, exactly. It's like maybe get contacts.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know. And like it's competently made and it's obviously trying to emulate other like great crime thrillers like Heat or LA Confidential. The gunfights are fun to watch and the steel blue colour correction speaks for a certain area. I don't think it was a bad era. Like I said, I watched this movie 11 years ago when I was staying with my uncle Brendan in Athlone, and neither of us were hugely keen on it then. But it goes to show how crap the current offering of crime thrillers is, that this has aged like half decent wine.
Mm.
We rented this on DVD from Extravision, for God's sake. For God's sake. You don't rent good movies on DVD from Extravision. Not anymore, anyway. And not certainly not back then. But anyway, on to Riseborough.
Yes.
I feel she gets short shrift here.
Ah, you see, I
think the character is good. She's an interesting character who's kind of admired among her colleagues because of her tenacity and similarity to like a younger version of Max. But the only place they go with the character sort of leads to a dead end.
But she kind of cracks the whole case, which I like.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a cool rug pull that, you know, leads to her in significant peril.
Yeah, that's true. And there's history and chemistry there between her and Max, but it's never developed enough. And I think Riseborough does great work in making a sketch feel like a flesh and blood woman. Unfortunately, her character is at the mercy of the plot and is essentially replaced in favour of this, like, Lewinsky-Sternwood team-up and by Juka, a different policeman played by Daniel Kaluuya when actual investigation work needs to be done.
Sure.
Yeah. Like, I think she's a good character. I just think the script isn't doing her many favours.
I get what you mean. I like that they set up that kind of she's feisty and tough, but maybe because she's younger and less burnt out than Lewinsky and doesn't have that kind of personal connection to Sternwood, that she's more level-headed. Like, I feel like Lewinsky's constantly running headfirst into danger in his desperation to catch Sternwood, and she's always like, you must chill.
Yeah. I'm amazed he can run.
Yeah, no, yeah. The knee, it's true. Yeah. Well, he does fall over during one of
a
the
a couple
chases.
Of times, yeah. And it's like, this guy should be on crutches.
It's actually, the needle thing is really good. Mm. You know, having to take the pulse and the where he puts on the coffee cup. You're like, ugh.
Yeah.
I think they have good chemistry, her and James McAvoy.
Yeah.
Because, like, I think the banter's really good. And, like, Lewinsky will be really, like, downbeat and gloomy. And Hawks will start, like, poking and prodding him with her words until the event she, like, breaks a little smile. And you feel like she's helping prevent him go completely off the rails with his demons. Yeah. And I think there's that nice moment where she comforts him as a mate during a moment of high emotion, but he's kind of frazzled mentally and he misreads as a romantic thing and he goes to kiss her, but she rejects him. And Riseborough completely silently in a close-up man just to convey for a brief second, like, I was going to kiss you, but that would be a mistake. But we're good
in a
really effortless way.
Yeah.
And but it's kind of ironic, I guess, that like, Lewinsky is constantly diving headfirst into shootouts and chases, whereas Riseborough's Hawks does the quieter police work, you know, rifling through records, surveillance, and about halfway through the movie, through doing this, she uncovers the central mystery, but, you know.
The central mystery also, some would say the central mystery then covers her.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And there's this really haunting moment where the penny drops for Hawks and she realizes she's in over her head. And Riseborough has these like beautiful big eyes, and just by widening them and increasing her breathing and uttering a few simple words quietly, she conveys Hawks' terror. She doesn't like go like, ah! It's a really good little detail. And I think what happens to that character kind of pushes the movie into a higher gear.
Yeah, I don't agree. I don't disagree with you, but...
You kind of wish she... I kind of forgot, because I'd seen the movie in 2013. It's the first time we're watching
it.
I kind of forgot she had such a... she wasn't in a lot of it.
Yeah. I just think that there is a better movie in there.
Mm.
I think there is like a London Heat in there, so to speak.
Sure.
And it's just not the movie we got.
Yeah. I think it kind of gets maybe a little too bogged down in the conspiracy.
Mm.
You kind of maybe if it was just... strip it down, it's McAvoy and Strong. That might have been better.
Sure. Yeah.
But do you want to talk about Oblivion?
Yeah, sure. The year is 2077. Earth lies abandoned but for drone technician Jack Harper, played by Tom Cruise, and his communications officer and romantic partner Victoria, played by Andrea Riseborough. Devastated by a nuclear war with alien scavengers, the planet is uninhabitable. 2 weeks away from completing their mission and joining the rest of humanity in space, Jack recovers an escape pod containing NASA astronaut Julia Harper, played by Olga Kurylenko. What Julia reveals about Earth, the war, and Jack himself sets him on a path of revenge and discovery.
Mission, this is Tower 4-9.
Go ahead, 4-9.
No. I'm having a problem with my technician.
You don't know what you're doing.
He found a survivor at the crash site.
Gotta listen to me.
She was impeding his abilities. And he's unfit for service.
No. I'm sorry to hear that, Victor. Are you still an effective team?
Open the goddamn door, Victor!
Yeah. We are not an effective team.
So if this all sounds really high concept, that's because it is. Oblivion's a really visually striking blockbuster from 2013 that manages to find real human emotion behind its utopia as dystopia sheen. But that requires ingesting a lot of lore and world building that, while a lot, also never really feels like enough. Have you seen this?
Yeah, I saw it in cinemas. Yeah. I remember a film very similar where it's like, this movie is cool, but it's not always that exciting.
Yeah, yeah. There's parts where like sort of the middle third where you're like, all right, come on, guys, pick up the pace. Yeah. There's no way a Tom Cruise fighting his clone can be this boring.
Yeah, sure. But then you'll see like the villain at the end. And you're like, oh, that's really sick.
Yeah, yeah. So. The action like feels tactile and as real as it possibly can, while the destroyed America reclaimed by nature is really stunning to look at. And the same goes for the sound or production design, which sort of makes you realize why they chose Joseph Kosinski for Top Gun Maverick 10 years later.
I think that's this movie's lasting legacy.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. Yeah, and that said, once the mystery starts to open up and more details are revealed, the film starts to slow down and you start to see the spit and tape sort of holding the story together. Like, I think the romance works really well between Jack Harper and Julia, Olga Kurylenko's character. But poor Andrea, though. She's again, 2013 was really like her breakout year in terms of like big movies, but she's just not in them very much and it feels like she's like...
If I recall, she does a good job at kind of the off-kilter vibe of her and Tom Cruise's like environment.
Yeah, yeah.
Like where you're like, everything's just a little too perfect.
Yeah, yeah. And she essentially feels sort of like a plot device as she does in Welcome to the Punch. And though Riseborough makes both characters feel like people with qualities, flaws and desires, the script never really gives you the time to make these characters feel as interesting as they could or should be. And I can't help but feel that Oblivion would be better off without Kurylenko and just sort of have Andrea Riseborough as both Victoria and Julia. And there's no point wishing for a movie that we didn't get, but, you know, I'm going to wish for it anyway. I just think Riseborough's more expressive face could sell the movie's big romantic lines, like where they're talking about when Tom Cruise's character proposed to Olga Kurylenko's character and she's like, do you remember what you said to me when you proposed? And he's like, no. And she's looking through a telescope at the New York skyline and an engagement ring appears in front of it. And she's like, look through here and I'll show you the future.
Oh. It's like, do you know, I actually, when you started describing it, I was like, I can see the telescope. I remember this
before you said
it. That is a really potent image.
And there's a bit where he's like putting her back into her like sleep pod before they go to the main climax of the movie to fight the villain. And he's just like, dream of us. And then as she goes to sleep, and I think those lines are well delivered and they really sell the like romance, the romantic plot of the movie. But I just think Riseborough would have been better at this.
Mm, yeah. Sure.
And this was back when Cruise's films didn't feel totally sexless either. So he has a spark between both women. And I just to reiterate, I just feel Riseborough is the more believable actress in this scenario.
Sure. Will we jump forward a few years to one of her most acclaimed roles, Mandy?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you have the plot for that?
I do, yes. So Red, played by Nicolas Cage, and Mandy Bloom, played by Andrea Riseborough, live a quiet, secluded life near the Shadow Mountains in California in 1983. This is disrupted by the arrival of a cult named the Children of the New Dawn, led by Jeremiah Sand, played by Linus Roach, who kidnap Mandy and torture Red. Consumed by rage and fueled by hallucinogens, Red swears revenge and goes on the warpath into an increasingly fantastical and nightmarish landscape populated by the cult, demonic bikers, and a tiger.
Crimson, primordial sky, the wretched warlock reached into the dark embrace. His fist closed around the serpent's eye. Strange and eternal.
I need you to get me that girl I saw. Do you know what to do?
A special one, Mandy. I too am a special one. Let us be so very special together.
That tiger scene is so trippy.
What's the where Richard Brake is like, a Jovan warrior sent forth from the eye of the storm. I love that line.
I have no idea what that scene is doing in the movie, but I love it.
Yeah. It's how he figures out through like a psychic connection where the cult is.
The LSD.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I think this is one of the most singular successful movies of the last few years. Mm. Just the way it takes what could be a standard revenge narrative, but sets it in a world like our own, but like heightened and fantastical and mythical, where demons and I guess black magic is more a part of everyday life. And that not only applies to the story, but also like Panos Cosmatos' direction, which is so psychedelic and colorful and atmospheric and hazy. I don't think there's a frame in this movie where something uninteresting is happening.
Yeah, that's true.
And you know, I know this movie is literally split in two with the title card drop in the middle, which is always a baller move. I always love when that happens. Even the worst movie, you're like, 30 minutes title card or whatever. But I actually think of the film more as a triptych, where Andrew Riseborough's character Mandy owns the first third, the villain of the piece Jeremiah Sand, who I think Linus Roach is amazing in this. I think he kind of owns the second part of it.
Get me, Brother Swan.
And then
he delivers his lines like he's chewing on gristle.
But it's just a weird time where sometimes he sounds really delicate, and then other times he's really, it's manic. It's really good. But then I think Nicolas Cage at his most primal kind of dominates the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
But
I think you're right about the triptych, and I think that might have been Panos Cosmatos' intention, because it does sort of opens it like the sparkly Shadow Mountains, 1983, and then it cuts to Children of the New Dawn, and then it cuts to like the Mandy
segment. Sure. That's true.
These are all title cards, I should clarify for anyone that hasn't seen the movie.
And I think Cosmatos and his co-writer Aaron Stjordan and Riseborough do pretty work in the first third, making the character of Mandy feel a lot more fleshed out than the victims in revenge movies often are. Like, for one, just the character has a lot more screen time. They really spend the time in that first third setting up through little details, like the scar under her left eye, that dark story she tells about her father and the birds. But while also never saying outright that, like, Mandy is a person who had this tough, tormented childhood, who has managed to find some level of quiet and peace amongst this woods, living with her kind lumberjack husband who tells dorky jokes, and with her, like, emo metal-inspired paintings she makes and her fantasy novels. But it's this peace and quiet that is cruelly ripped away when she catches the eye of this cult leader who becomes obsessed with her. And I like, even when she ultimately winds up in his clutches, the character has this defiance. The bit where he's trying to seduce her by playing the psychedelic folk song he wrote, which they actually released. Do you know that?
I did. It was in my Spotify, like,
top
raps.
Five. Amulet of the Weeping Maze.
Jeremiah Sand is a righteous man. Yeah. I remember it well.
It's 7 minutes long, which made me laugh, because I was like, of course it is.
Yeah.
Mandy at that point's already been drugged by this cultist played by Ireland's own Olwen Fuere. I never know how to say her name.
Sure. I think you'd have to go back to the Anglo-Normans to really figure it out. But
I'm
Fuere.
Played by Ireland's own Olwen Fuere. who's also in a new Irish folk horror this month, looks really good, called All You Need Is Death.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, she's drugged with this venom from this big insect kept in a jar, which is so creepy. But even then, Mandy is like, you wrote the song? And then starts like hysterically laughing and embarrasses Sand in front of all his followers. I really like that they gave her that moment.
Mm, yeah, yeah. That's good.
What about you? What do you think of Risebrough in this?
Yeah, I think Risebrough sort of plays Mandy as a woman who's been sort of so hurt by the world, she seeks to escape from it. And, you know, she loves her home, her boyfriend, and the art she makes, but not much else. It's sort of why she's so standoffish when she comes in contact with Mother Marlene, who's Alwyn Ferre's character, and downright cruel when she's kidnapped by the cults. Well, cruel is maybe a bit of a misnomer. She's responding to her situation appropriately, I would say, as she would. And I think the cult are sort of chasing something that has already passed them by, led by a man desperate to reclaim past glories that were never really that glorious to begin with. You know, okay, you wrote a 7-minute folk song. Good job. Lots of people do that.
Yeah.
And they're often shit. You're just lucky enough you got to release your shit song. Mandy has all she needs, basically. You know, she's happy in her life, whereas the cult and the cultists within it never will be. They're never going to find the supposed paradise they're traveling to. And that's sort of why she laughs to them. You know, I think she realizes that in her head, even if she's about to die, then, you know, she sort of had led a good life, no matter how short it was. Whereas the cult just descend essentially deeper and deeper into hell the further the movie goes. You know, by the end of it, it's just Nicolas Cage and Linus Roach in a pit as he, like, digs his thumbs into his eye sockets and crushes his skull. So, yeah, I'd rather live in a log cabin quietly than ever experience anything like that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And I think this film is also, like, really funny in parts. You know, it's got the cheddar goblin that vomits mac and cheese onto children.
On the TV show.
Yeah, on the TV show. And that bit where he meets Bill Duke when he's getting his crossbow back and he's like, I should warn you that these people are very dangerous and you will probably die. Nicolas Cage is like, don't be negative.
That's great.
And then there's the Joven Warrior line again, which I love. I love that scene. That's my favourite scene in the movie with the chemist, because everything is just so loud and bright and off kilter, and they're speaking to each other, like, mentally as well. Like, yeah, it's just like voiceover lines most of the time, and there's just a tiger pacing in the cage. Oh, great stuff. And then it cuts to, like, this, like, dissolve image of a tiger roaring over, like, mountains. Great stuff.
It is. It's really... Yeah. I don't know, like, a visceral experience, like sensory.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd love to see it on the big screen. I've never have.
Full disclosure, I watch it stoned all the time, and it's great. Would highly recommend anyone do that if they have access.
I love
the film and illicit substances.
Sure. I love the way Risebrough is styled in this. Genuinely make her look ethereal in a way that's really, really cool. Just to wrap up, I wanted to point out that I wanted to say this in the last episode when talking about Cage, but I forgot. His next three movies sound incredible. He's in Osgood Perkins' new enigmatic horror, Long Legs, teasers for which look incredible. Yeah. He's working with Ben Brewer again, who directed The Trust, which is one of his best straight-to-DVD movies from that era.
The one with Elijah Wood?
Yeah, that one
I've
rules.
Seen half of that.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
But it's a... The movie that they made together is called Arcanian, and it was actually shot in Ireland. It's a monster flick.
Oh, deadly.
And he's working with Irish director Lorcan Finnegan, who made Vivarium and Nocebo, on a thriller called The Surfer.
Nice.
So we might get some surfing.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage on a board. Yeah. I should say, at this point, we're about 26 minutes into the podcast, and if you've listened this far, thank you so much. It means you're a great listener, but it also means that you're exactly the kind of person that the Samaritans are looking for.
The charity is always looking for volunteers for their late night shifts, something you might just fit the bill for perfectly. Because the Samaritans say you don't need to be a psychologist or a counsellor. In fact, all you have to do is be able to listen to somebody talking for an average of 26 minutes.
To find out more, go to listening.ie.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
As you heard in the intro, this show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, Ireland's largest network of independent podcasts. There's plenty of other great shows to check out on the network. Here's a taster of one.
Welcome to the Baby Tribe Podcast, your essential companion through the journey of parenting. I'm Professor Afif Al-Kafash, a neonatologist, paediatrician, researcher and lactation consultant at the Rotunda Hospital Dublin and the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland.
And I'm Katie Mugan, a paediatric and public health nurse and a lactation consultant. Together, with over 40 years of experience in caring for infants and children, we're here to share expert insights, inspiring stories, and give you access to an amazing array of experts in parenting and the field of paediatrics. And we're covering topics that span all the childhood years, from infancy straight through to the adolescence. We're going to cover it all.
It's not going to be just about the challenges. It's going to be about the joys, the milestones, and stories that will hopefully warm your heart. And I'm sure, Katie, you're still going to give me as much abuse as you did before.
It's going to be a great season. Afif, and we're so pleased to have all you guys join with us.
Available every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts, in association with the Headstuff Podcast Network.
I know that Face are also delighted to finally get to tell listeners about Headstuff Plus. Headstuff Plus is the one-stop shop for everything on the Headstuff Podcast Network, Ireland's largest podcast network and the one to which I Know That Face belongs. If you're a fan of I Know That Face or any other shows on the network, become a member of Headstuff Plus and get bonus episodes of Headstuff shows, other exclusive content, merchandise, early access to live events, and lots more. We here at I Know That Face have already recorded a handful of bonus episodes where myself and Andrew talk about more current news and releases in the world of film and TV. But also in the future, we have plans for more actor-themed series as well, along with releasing episode outtakes, accompanying articles, etc., all for Headstuff Plus subscribers. To sign up to Headstuff Plus, it's just €5 plus VAT per month. When you sign up, no matter what show or shows you are supporting, you still get access to everything. All the bonus material for all the podcasts on the network. A lot of great podcasts. Plus, by doing so, you'll be supporting I Know That Face to bring you more top material. For all the details and to sign up, visit headstuffpodcasts.com. And now, back to the show.
Andrew, we talked about The Grudge.
Yes, yes. In 2006, Detective Muldoon, played by Andrea Riseborough, moves to the town of Cross River in Pennsylvania to start a new job with her son. When she and her partner, Detective Goodman, played by Damian Butcher, investigate the murder of care worker Lorna Moody, played by Jackie Weaver. Maybe I should be doing accents every time I mention someone's being played by, make it a bit more interesting. They find it ties back to the house at 44 Rayburn Drive, the site of multiple murders. As Muldoon looks further into its history, the awful power of the curse begins to manifest itself in her life as well.
Detective Wilson? I'm Detective Muldoon. The doctor said that she told you that I was going to come see you.
Did you find my tapes?
Your tapes, sir? I came to ask you some questions about a case that you worked 2 years ago. What can you tell me about the Landers family?
It's happening again, isn't it? Once you step into the place where they died, it never lets you go. This is never going to end.
What will never end?
That house is Grudge. There she is. You went into the Landers' house, didn't you?
Do you know much about The Grudge, Stephen? Or Ju-on?
I've seen
its Japanese name.
The original Japanese Ju-on The Grudge, which I think is like the third in the franchise, maybe? And I've seen that. I like it.
Mm.
And I've seen this version. I haven't seen any of the other American remakes.
Oh, okay. No. So just give listeners some context. I'm sure plenty know this already, but the Grudge or Ju-on series, depending on what side of the Pacific you're on, is a sprawling cinematic universe that totals 8 Japanese films, 4 American films, a crossover with the Ring series called Sadako versus Kayako, and a Japanese Netflix series. All the films follow a similar formula of a non-linear narrative depicting how a curse born of resentment affects all those who step into the house where it was first created by the murder of Kayako Saiki, originally played by Takako Fuji, her son Toshio, and his pet cat by Kayako's husband. So all the films in this series that I have seen have been, at worst, okay. And the rest are, and anything above that is usually good to great. But I do see how the narrative gimmick could sort of wear on or confuse some viewers.
I remember finding the first one kind of hard to follow.
Yeah. The first film essentially
or
sets
up... Or not the first one, but you know, the one.
The first film sets up this sort of no one gets out alive premise and every single after it Every single film after it follows through on this like nihilistic, nasty promise, with the methods of execution becoming more cruel and gory as the series goes on. And I've seen most of the films in the series, barring the sort of mid-2000s reboot films and the second and third American sequels, and the very first two short films. So I speak with a reasonable amount of authority on these films. I bought the Arrow box set, is what I'm saying, and watched it recently. I think the 2020 film is one of the best, and I think outside of this recording studio, I'm probably one of the few that thinks this way.
It's really slept on. I didn't prepare notes on it because I watched it a couple of weeks ago. But last night I was like, oh, I'll just throw it on. I'll watch 30 minutes of it. I watched the whole thing.
Mm.
I think it's really gripping.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's necessarily like the most scary movie, but I think it's got a great like doom-laden vibe.
Yeah, it's got a great atmosphere.
And I like that it's kind of a detective story. And I like the... I think it does the shuffling narratives in a way that's not confusing.
Yeah, yeah. And all the characters...
The actors are
really good, yeah.
And even like Betty Gilpin as John Cho's wife.
Yeah.
Really like leaves a big impression.
Yeah,
And Jackie Weaver and...
William Sadler. And...
I was thinking about my Letterboxd review for this would be... do you know the way in like most horror movies... Oh, this family has a really nice life.
And then
they get possessed by a curse or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
This one is like, what if there were three different stories and all their lives were miserable and then they got hit by a curse?
Yeah, yeah.
And I get why that could be a tough hang for people.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
I do like it though.
Yeah, it has like one of my favorite sort of aesthetics, which I can best describe as rotten Americana.
Mm.
So it's sort of set in a small town that most people have forgotten about. Local industry and politics are non-existent. Public infrastructure is in a downward spiral, and the locals are all depressed with the state of their shitty lives. Violent crime, disease and rot are all rampant, and the weather is crap too. But that's just Dublin. So this is sort of the perfect breeding ground for a malevolent supernatural force. So what's a filmmaker to do when there is no hope? He gives his audience the illusion of hope and then snatches it away in the last few seconds. So I think all three narrative threads in this film are well handled and interesting, even if the film doesn't have the time to flesh them all out fully, maybe. But like none of the Grudge films have really the time to do that. But what they do is usually pretty good. And therefore it's a sort of Detective Muldoon storyline that has the most weight to it. She is a loving mother and was also a devoted wife, but now widowed, she has almost no time for her son because of the move and her job and this new case. She's a filmmaker's idea of a good cop in that she sets out to change the world in some small or big way, and that spark still exists in her despite life's hardships. She's rational and logical and desperate for something that can be explained and solved in comparison to her husband's death, which was cruelly inexplicable by all accounts. And her desire to do the right thing by her new town, her new colleagues and by her son essentially doom her to a short life of obsession and paranoia. And that's what makes it a perfect Grudge film, even if that wasn't necessarily what people wanted in like late 2019, early 2020.
Sure. Yeah, because this got like an F cinema score.
That's crazy.
Very poor reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. I think it has like maybe 20% or something. I don't know the exact figure.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that even if you are, it's a tough hang, as I said, it's very well made.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that tough hang, it feels intentional. Like it's part of the themes of the movie.
Yeah.
So I just find that the vitriol towards it very unusual.
Yeah.
And the fact that as well that it came from Nicholas Pesci, who I think we've covered before in the show because we did Piercing.
Piercing, yeah.
And his first movie, Eyes of My Mother, is really good. And I think The Grudge, it didn't really even like compromise his like vision too much.
No,
I think they feel like a part of the same filmmaker's filmography.
Absolutely.
And I think the last shot of this movie is really, really good.
Yeah.
And I also think this movie does a really good job at putting J-horror tropes into like a Hollywood franchise, where I feel like there's a lot of stuff in this movie that like, oh, that's kind of from Dark Water or that's kind of Ring.
Yeah,
it's not just Grudge movies. Mm. So I'm very impressed with this movie.
Yeah, I really like it. And I would encourage anyone that likes a tough hang to go check it out.
It's on Netflix right now. Can I talk about To Leslie?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah,
yes. Andrea Riseborough stars in this drama as Leslie Lee Rowland, who viewers are first introduced to as a young single mother with her young boy on a segment of the news because she has just won $190,000 in a local lottery. The movie then cuts to 6 years later and Lee is getting evicted from an apartment for not paying rent. We quickly realise she's an alcoholic, and now homeless she attempts to find a place to stay, first with her adult son, played by Owen Teague, then with old friends, played by Alison Janney and Stephen Root. However, after falling out with these people, she resorts to sleeping rough on the grounds of a local motel. The owner of the motel, Sweeney, played by Marc Maron, takes pity on her and offers her a job and room and board. And his kindness eventually makes Lee want to turn her life around and kick her addiction.
You stole money from Darren. What?
You stole money from Darren.
I didn't steal money. Did he tell you that?
Come on, lie to me again. Lie to me again.
I'm your mother. I would not steal money from you. What are you doing? Get off of me.
Unfucking believable.
You fucking chicken shit. Hey, fat baby. Hey. Hey.
What did I say? No drinking.
I'm your mother. You cannot talk to me this way, James.
Mother?
Yes, your mama. Stop.
You're a drunk.
I am sick.
I'm not gonna do this again. I'm not.
You? What about me? We were supposed to have a good life. I didn't want this for you.
I had a good life until you showed up. I'm not even 20. I can't even drink yet, and I have to take care of my mother. I have to take care of you.
So this is like a 70s style character drama about a flawed but compelling character working things out. We meet Lee deep into her addiction, where she's doing things like stealing money from her son's roommate to buy naggins of vodka, which she drinks straight. And watching, you know, like that isn't a good thing to do, like stealing, but you also know that she can't help it.
Yeah, yeah.
And like a lot of movies about addiction, it's about like the reason a person becomes addicted in the first place. In Lee's case, she started drinking because like despite her lotto win, she was unhappy. But now a lot of her unhappiness is rooted in her drinking, and how do you break that cycle? And the movie's about how that requires making huge life changes. And I also think it's a movie about having the right support, because Lee at first goes to stay with her son, James, who I think is 20, and he loves his mom and he wants to take care of her, but he doesn't know how. He doesn't have the resources. He can't be with her 24 hours a day. He has a job. And so he's obviously deeply hurt when she lets him down.
Yeah.
And then she goes to stay with Allison Janney and Stephen Root's characters, who are better equipped to mind Lee. But after 6 years of being similarly disappointed by her, they seem to have lost compassion. Like they talk down to her and joke about her to their other friends within earshot of Lee. And in the case of the movie, it's ultimately Sweeney, maybe because he already has some experience dealing with a loved one battling addiction, who's able to get through to her, treating her with kindness, giving her a job and a place to stay, but also being strict about making sure Lee does her tasks and doesn't take advantage of him. And as well as being a sort of 70s character drama, To Leslie also feels like a country song in movie form, because it has a mostly country music soundtrack. It's set in Texas. Characters talk about Willie Nelson. There's also that classic joke about country music. What do you get when you play a country music record backwards? You get your wife back, your truck back, your dog back. And the movie has a bit of that, in that like Lee had all she thought she wanted and lost it, squandered it, but maybe worked out what's most important along the way. And I think Riser's pretty spectacular throughout the movie. She brings such incredible authenticity to her portrayal of someone in the throes of alcoholism, the different levels of drunk, trying to hide being intoxicated, dealing with being hungover, and the symptoms of withdrawal. But even when her addiction causes her to do bad things and like scream insults at any person who calls her out for these things, there is a warmth to her, maybe in those big eyes I mentioned before, that makes you want to follow her on her journey. And there's a part in the movie where she lets down Sweeney and he's disappointed in her, and the guy who co-runs the motel with him, Royal, played by Andre Royo from The Wire, he says to her, you know, some people can't see a good thing even when it's dropped on their plate. And Leslie goes to a bar and this Willie Nelson song called Are You Sure is playing, and the lyrics are, look around you, look down the bar from you at the faces that you see, are you sure this is where you want to be? And Lee mutters to herself something like, is this a joke? But then in this like long unbroken shot, and I should say like this movie is filmed with great but subtle style by a TV veteran, but like first time feature filmmaker, Michael Morris. But we watch Lee have this visceral reaction to the song and reckon maybe properly for the first time about what's happened to her, what she's done. And it's incredible acting by Riseborough. And it leads to this dark night of the soul for Lee, where she visits the house that she used to live with. With James as a boy before he was taken away from her. And Lee goes to Sweeney the next morning and says something like, you know, I know I messed up, but I want to stay and I appreciate all you've done for me. And not only do you realize this might be the first time Lee's been properly sober throughout the whole movie, but you also buy the rapid change, and that's down to Riseborough. And nails the Southern accent, which is hard, because I will say I watched a film recently that was set in a Pennsylvania town and had three great Irish actors in the lead roles, and it was a bit rough. You feel something's off. Not in this case. And she has sparkling chemistry with Marc Maron, who's great in this too. you really believe him as this guy who's just inherently decent, but who has also had his own personal struggles. And I've seen this movie twice now, and I think their unusual dynamic is what has made this a weirdly rewatchable film for me. And I want to say, like, Riseborough was Oscar nominated for this, but there was a bit of controversy over it because the distributor for the movie didn't fund an Oscars campaign. So I think she, the movie's director, and his wife, Mary McCormack, who's also an actress, organized their own campaign, which involved contacting famous actors and letting them watch the film and saying to them, like, something like, we think the movie's really good. If you like it, spread the word. And it worked. She got the nomination, but it was kind of tainted by speculation that the campaign may have breached Academy rules. It ultimately wasn't found to. The nomination stood. Reading about it, I don't think the two Leslie people did anything hugely different to the type of Oscar campaigning that goes on routinely.
Yeah,
I don't really get the difference between putting up big posters and ads in the trades to asking people, like, hey,
saying for your consideration.
Yeah, exactly. And as opposed to just telling people, like, hey, check out this movie, and if you like it, maybe raise awareness for it. Either way, you're still getting the word out about the movie. And I actually maybe like the latter more, because there's people kind of standing over it. You know, like, Charlize Theron and Edward Norton like this. That's interesting. I'll check it out, you know, as opposed to, like, Netflix. And I think it's great that small indies like this can still break through to the heights of the Academy Awards. And I think Riseborough more than deserved it. And I think the reporting around the two Leslie nomination felt like the movie and Riseborough were almost being punished for securing entry to the Oscars club based on sheer effort and talent as opposed to money. But I think it's a great movie, and I think
talent.
I just think this movie will, I think, will last.
No, either way, I think it's, like, I haven't seen Two Lazy, but either way, I think it's, like, well-deserved. And, you know, I know Riseborough's only in her early 40s, but it still feels long overdue.
Yeah, for sure. Can I also talk about Matilda the musical?
Yeah, go for it, yeah. Let's end on a cheerful note.
So you know the Roald Dahl story, Matilda? Genius kid, raised by very dumb parents who hate her, has a very mean principal in school, gains telekinetic powers. This movie is based on the 2010 smash hit musical from Dennis Kelly and Tim Minchin, based on the Roald Dahl novel.
A baby? I'm not having a baby. What on earth gives you that idea? I'm not listening to this. This is quackery.
But you're about to give birth.
Are you out of your mind?
Mrs. Wormwood, you're having a contraction.
I'm not having contractions. Contractions are for pregnant women. We're having babies. I'm having a stinking baby.
Every life I bring into this world.
And my reasons for picking this were threefold. One, I heard it was good. Two, for as much as we've talked about Riseborough being in very serious projects, what I like about her is that she's also down to clown. Like, she's in comedies like The Death of Stalin and Mindhorn and this. She's pretty funny in Birdman, if I recall. So I wanted to highlight that other string to her bow. Also, the child actress who plays Matilda in this movie is Alicia Weir, who's Irish. And as well as playing the titular character in Matilda the musical, she's also playing the titular character in the new horror movie Abigail out this month.
Yeah. I can't wait for that.
So this is the new movie from Radio Silence, who made Ready or Not in the last two Scream movies. And she plays a ballet dancing kid vampire.
Yeah.
Who, I'm so excited for it. Between all that, I figured it was a good time to catch up on Matilda. And it's really fun. Performances are excellent, particularly Weir. There are some real earworm songs, you know, like, we are revolting children living in revolting times. We sing revolting songs, you sing revolting rhymes. The dance choreography looks pretty amazing, particularly when you think of it, a lot of it's being done by children. I will say it's based on a children's novel, so I'd say you'd be better off watching it maybe with younger relatives than on your own as you take notes to talk about it on the podcast. And I did find myself overthinking the story in an adult way at times, being like, well, why doesn't Miss Honey simply go to work in a different school away from the villainous Miss Trunchbull? But why overthink it? Riseborough and Stephen Graham, really fun in it, playing Matilda's awful idiot parents. I don't know how much of this is in the doll story or played up for the movie, but they are comically dumb. Like, Riseborough's mom character, who's just referred to as Mrs. Wormwood, she's introduced in a maternity ward, visibly 9 months pregnant, telling a doctor, a baby? I'm not having a baby. What on earth gives you that idea? I'm not listening to this. This is quackery. And the doctor's like, you're literally about to give birth. And she's like, are you out of your mind? And starts having contractions. And the doctor's like, you're having contractions. And she says, I'm not having contractions. Contractions are for pregnant women. So she has Matilda, but Mr. Wormwood, Pippa Graham, is upset that she's not a boy. And the doctor tells him, like, your wife has just given birth to a beautiful, healthy, happy little girl. She's perfect. This is fantastic news. And it hard cuts to the new parents, like, leaving the hospital being like, why do bad things happen to good people? Fine, upstanding citizens like you and me. And Mr. Wormwood is like, with no sign of a winky dink at all. And
you've gotten a lot more confident at your singing since you started that band, Steve.
Thank you so much. Check out Glass Embers, yeah. Running on Spotify.
It's a
now.
Great single.
Thank you so much. And, you know, over the course of the movie, they reveal themselves to be very bad people, not just in their emotional abuse of Matilda, but also, side spoilers, they're forced to flee the UK because Mr. Wormwood is a car dealer who conned several customers who came into his store who turned out worked for the mafia. And while Mr. Wormwood would probably have done that anyway because he is a dope, it didn't help that Riseborough's Mrs. Wormwood had already put him in serious debt through overspending. And Mrs. Wormwood is always styled to the nines, coiffed hair, huge earrings, these over the top kitschy outfits, even though we never see her outside of just her house. And all the while she's like dropping gem lines like, I have a whole house to run, dinners don't microwave themselves, you know. There's a funny running gag throughout the movie that she doesn't seem to understand metaphors. Mr. Wormwood will be describing how a guy came into his car lot who was like a great big bear of a man, and she's like, oh lovely, but do bears drive? It's all very entertaining, and Riseborough really commits to the lunacy. And I thought this was sweet. I saw in an interview with her where she basically said, hey, look, it was a wonderful experience making the movie and playing the Wormwoods, but being really mean to a child for 6 months on and off is actually quite miserable. And she said she had to keep apologizing to Weir off screen after takes. And yeah, no, it's a good movie. It's on Netflix right now. Is that everything?
I believe so.
Great. Yeah. Email iknowthefacepod@gmail.com if you'd like to reach out to the show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Please leave us an iTunes rating if you would be so kind. For those who want more of the pod, sign up to Headstuff Plus for €5 plus tax a month, where you can listen to exclusive bonus episodes of the show. Last episode that went up was our Jennifer Garner Peppermint one, if you want to hear us talk about a vengeance movie that is not as good as Mandy, where the victims don't really have that much of a role in the movie. Andrew, where can people find more of your work?
You can find me at that Stuff Gaming section, where we talk about what we play, why we play, and how we play it, and at Fortnite Frights at WordPress, where I talk about the most influential horror movies of the year, every year, starting with 1920.
Right. You can check me out at joe.ee, where I write a lot about movies. See you later, cinephiles.
Bye-bye.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.